From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Home invasions, kidnappings, shootouts are some of the ways that Mexican drug cartel violence has crossed the border into the U.S. But that's nothing compared to what's going on in Mexico. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Mexican drug cartel violence on both sides of the border. First, we'll hear from a Mexican journalist who had to send his family across the border into the U.S. for their safety. He's the publisher of an influential newspaper chain in Mexico. Then we'll talk with New York Times reporter Randall Archibald, who wrote a front-page story yesterday about how cartel violence has spilled over into the U.S. And we'll talk about the new border security initiative announced today by Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kidnappings, home invasions, and shootouts are some examples of how the violence surrounding the Mexican drug cartels has spilled over into the U.S., particularly in border states. Mexican drug trafficking organizations pose a national security threat to the U.S., according to Attorney General Eric Holder. Today, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano outlined plans to bolster security on the border. She announced this in advance of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Mexico tomorrow. One of the people directly threatened by drug cartel violence is my guest, Alejandro Junco de la Vega. He's the publisher of perhaps the most influential newspaper chain in Mexico, Grupo Reforma. And because his reporters cover the cartels and the drug violence, their lives and his life have been threatened. Junco sent his family across the border to Texas for their safety. It's not the first time he's been in a tough spot. He's run the newspaper chain since 1973. Alejandro Junco, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the risks in covering the cartels and the drug wars in your newspaper? What has happened to some of your reporters?
Well, we have become under siege by the drug lords and the cartels of the country. And the more that we expose their activities, the harder they push back. For example, recently, two reporters from our Monterrey paper a few months ago pursued a story. They had heard that a man running a tire rethread shop in a nearby town was being shaken down for protection money, because this is how the drug rigs have been, quote, diversifying. And our reporter and photographer paid a visit to the town. Not 10 minutes after they had arrived, armored vehicles pulled up outside, blocking their exit. They were thrown to the ground, their laptops, their camera equipment, their phones, their ID with their addresses were all taken, and they were beaten with broken eardrums, shoulders, ribs. They both were hospitalized, and they both quit their jobs. And this is not the first time that such a thing has happened, and the criminals have made it plain. Unless we leave them alone, it will not be the last.
Well, how do you get people to cover the drug wars, given that their lives are in danger if they do?
Well, it's getting more and more difficult, and so we have to adjust. We have to make changes, and our lives are the worst for it. We can no longer run our reporters as bylines. We have to change their beats. We move them from homes to safer apartments. We vary routes to evade kidnappers, and our families cannot be habitual in their daily lives. And last year, for the second time in four decades, I had to move my entire family to a safe haven in the U.S.
The drug cartels in Mexico are famous, among other things, for buying people off. Cops, military, government people. What about journalists? Do you have to worry that your reporters might be bribed by the cartels?
Yes, this is a concern. And we have, for many years, run an education program that attempts to illustrate just our commitment to society. We cannot be in any kind of cooperation with the cartels in any way. And so we have to do our jobs. We have to be very clear about what conflicts of interest might arise. And, some people have quit their jobs because they feel it's dangerous. And but those that have stayed behind, the great, great majority, are honest, they're diligent, and they believe that we have an important job to do. And if we don't do it, the truth is not going to be out. We have every reason in the world to drop the stories, and we have every reason to look the other way, but we have resolved to continue to report all we know about the problem and continue to ask questions. And we hold to the faith that if we ask enough of them, we may finally come upon a solution. And what we know so far is like a conundrum. In Mexico, crime pays.
Would you give us a sense of the scope of the drug cartels in Mexico, how big they are, to what extent they've infiltrated mainstream institutions?
Well, this is a very worrisome statistic that we just heard recently from a creditable U.S. source. There are about 450,000 people directly or indirectly linked to the drug trade in Mexico. One of the problems that we face is that the risk of being a criminal is very low in our country. Only about 5% of crimes are reported. Of that 5%, only 1 out of 6 victims press charges. And only one very unlucky criminal out of 100 will eventually go to jail.
Give us a sense of to what extent the cartels have infiltrated mainstream society, either through bribing people in powerful positions or having their own plants in powerful positions.
Yes, we have a very serious infiltration of this young democracy at the municipal, at the state and the federal level. And not only that, but we also have it in our judicial and legislative branches. And for example, the mayoral elections that are coming up in the next weeks, we've heard of numerous cases where a well-dressed man shows up at the campaign office for the mayor. And, you know, he is well-dressed and a well-educated person. And he is carrying with him a suitcase full of money. And he is bringing good wishes for a successful political career. And at that time, the candidate has no choice. You know, we say plata o plomo, silver or lead. As mayor, he must collaborate. And at that moment, the fix is in. And so this is a situation that has caused a lot of potentially good people to refrain from participating in mayoral elections. We have cases in Ixtapan de la Sal, for example, where the mayor was shot and killed, and his stand-in replacement refused to accept the position because of the danger that is associated with such a position.
One of the great paradoxes of the drug wars in Mexico that have spilled over into the United States is that guns are very hard to get in Mexico because of pretty strict gun laws. And they're much easier to purchase in the United States. So a lot of the guns that are arming the cartels are actually coming across the border from the United States into Mexico. Talk about what impact you think the more liberal gun laws of the United States is having on violence in Mexico now.
Well, guns in Mexico are very, very difficult to acquire legally.
It sounds like it's one of the few institutions that's really working in Mexico now, is the strict gun laws.
Yes, and it cannot be done unless it is done through the army itself. However, the armament that is in the possession of the drug cartels, I would say 90% has come from the U.S., and it's understandable that you have liberal laws on this side of the border, and but the fact is that a great majority of those that are in Mexico are probably illegally in the country as a result of contraband, smuggling, whatever. And you can see a very large percentage of the gun dealers cater to the border towns in Mexico. And it's a disproportionate amount. So I would propose that perhaps it's worth looking into how the laws of the U.S. cannot be used against its own interests, which is to have a peaceful neighbor.
Are the cartels better armed than the police?
Frequently they are. The police is not particularly well-armed in our country. The military are better armed. And now the military has jumped into the battle as a result of President Calderon's insistence that they go out and help with this tremendous problem. And I would say that very frequently they are, not necessarily always. But when the army comes in to fight its side of the battle, they face the same problem that the U.S. Army faced in Iraq. Where do I point? Who do I shoot?
You know, in addition to the cartels using AK-47s and grenade launchers, they're also using more primitive tactics to scare people, gruesome things like beheadings, dissolving bodies in acid baths. Is that terrorizing the population?
It is, and it is having an impact on the levels of investment, and it is having an impact on the levels of job creations. It used to be that emigration from Mexico was only happening at the lower echelons of society, those without a job, those that wanted to find a way for a better life. And now we are beginning to see that happen in the top echelons of society, people that are fleeing the country, not because they don't have a job or they don't have a means to support themselves, but because they fear for their safety.
My guest is Alejandro Junco, publisher of a Mexican newspaper chain called Grupo Reforma. We'll talk about the Mexican drug cartels more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alejandro Junco, and he publishes an influential chain of newspapers in Mexico, and we're talking about the impact of the drug cartels in Mexico. Have addiction levels in Mexico been increasing as the drug cartels have become more powerful and as they've increased the supply of drugs in Mexico?
Yes, that is a truism. More and more we are seeing the public health element become a bigger element, and one that is approaching the levels that probably exist in the U.S. And so this has created an internal market for drugs that at some point back in history, you know, Mexico was more like a pathway to the drugs that were being sold in the U.S. with no local consumption. But that has changed.
Last fall, President Calderon proposed decriminalizing possession of small quantities of cocaine and other drugs for addicts who agreed to undergo treatment. Why did he do that? What was the explanation for that proposal?
Well, I think that more and more people in Mexico are urging him to pull the ripcord. And what I mean by pulling the ripcord is, you know, the loss of our country. And we're running out of good ideas. And I'm certain that this may not be a good idea, but where are the others? And so even though it might be imperfect, I think that the thought behind this is to let some of the hot air out of the balloon so that we diminish the amount of illegal money that is being fed into this trade. And it's probably an imperfect solution, and one that I don't think is going to be popular, but we're running out of good ideas.
Well, the idea certainly didn't go over well in the United States. It was opposed in the United States. What impact did that have on Mexico? Was there pressure from the Bush administration or from Congress?
Well, no pressure needed, just inaction. You know, if the U.S. does not, you know, legalize its consumption of drugs, Mexico probably could not do it on its own. So it's going to require some soul searching to see if we can come up with some coordinated effort. But to make matters worse, I sometimes fear that even if consumption were to stop overnight in the U.S., that still would not accomplish what is needed in Mexico. The Merida Initiative, which is a plan to help Mexico combat the drug cartels.
This is a plan passed by Congress in the United States to give Mexico about $1.4 billion in equipment and training over the course of 3 years to help stem the drug wars.
Well, you know, I have heard arguments based on reason that even if that initiative were to be very successful and we were able to stop them cold, there are still other illegal activities that are very, very worrisome. We have the problem of kidnappings. We have the problem of piracy. We have the problem of extortions, of sale of protection. And these are problems that might even become more acute if the drug business were to dry up. So I think that it is not fair to say, well, the U.S. is to blame because it has this huge market. Well, even if it stopped tomorrow, it's not unthinkable that we would still have the violence and we would still have the lawlessness. And so I think we need to think hard about just what it is we're asking.
Some analysts think that Mexico is in danger of becoming a failed state. Do you think that that's extreme?
I hope it is. But we are seeing manifestations that are worrisome. For example, a feudalization where different parts of the country are essentially run by different drug cartels. We are seeing the infiltration of this young elected democracies. We are seeing this rule of law problems. And I just don't know what it takes to declare it a, quote, failed state. But certainly there are aspects of the operation of government in Mexico that are simply dysfunctional.
Hillary Clinton, who's the U.S. Secretary of State, will be in Mexico Wednesday and Thursday of this week. What do you expect that she'll be discussing in Mexico?
Well, it's very encouraging that she is there and that she has apparently made it a higher priority in the agenda that was true of the last administration. So I must say that that is encouraging. She probably will be taken to a lot of nice facilities and shown around in a proud manner. But she's an intelligent woman, and I think that it would be very interesting that she dig deep into some of the realities and some of the dilemmas that we are facing. And our problems might soon be your problems, and they are problems that I would not wish on anyone.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called Mexico's drug trafficking organizations a national security threat to the U.S. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think that the problems are contagious and that we need to work on them jointly. There's a lot of ironies in this, even a certain dark humor to be found. I know that a few weeks ago, for example, an expert from the U.S. was invited to Saltillo, a city in North Eastern Mexico, to give a talk and to offer advice on how to keep ourselves safe from kidnappers. His lectures went well, but within hours of the last one, he was kidnapped. And there's founded fear we'll never see him again. So this is just one small example of things that are going on and that you know, could be multiplied if we don't stop this in time.
You've been publishing your chain of newspapers since 1973, and you took it over from your family. It was already run by your family. What were the big issues then? What were the stories that were most risky to cover back in 1973?
Well, at that time, we had to purchase our raw material, our newsprint, from the government. The manufacture and sale of newsprint was a monopolistic activity of the federal government. So you can imagine if at the height of the Watergate scandal, Mrs. Katharine Graham of the Washington Post had to buy her raw material from Richard Nixon, what might have happened?
Yes, there might have been newspaper paper shortages, huh?
as they were in our case.
Yes, we got nothing to sell, no paper left. Did you face that? Did they tell you there was no paper?
Absolutely. We faced this back in September of 1974. We were entering the eighth month of the year, and they had given us 17% of our allowed quota. And that same month, a new newspaper was born in our city, you know, with unlimited supply. So it didn't take bayonets and soldiers in the newsroom to get the government's point across. And so over the years, we faced many problems and controls, but nothing like the violence and the criminality that has us under siege today.
Alejandro Hunkel, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
Alejandro Hunkel is the publisher of the Mexican newspaper chain Grupo Reforma. He'll give the commencement address at Columbia University this spring. We'll talk about how Mexican drug violence has spilled over into the U.S. in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. From LendingTree, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. And from DK Eyewitness Travel, publisher of full-color guidebooks that help travelers visualize and plan trips through 3D maps and sample itineraries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Mexican drug cartels' distribution networks have reached about 230 U.S. cities and towns. Coming up, we talk with Randall Archibald, who wrote yesterday's front-page New York Times story about how Mexican drug cartel violence has spilled over into the U.S. And we'll talk about the new border security initiative announced today by Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Randall Archibald, wrote yesterday's front-page New York Times story about how Mexican drug cartels have extended their reach across the U.S. Archibald is a national correspondent for the New York Times. He covers the Southwest and the Mexican-American border. A little later, we'll discuss the new border security initiative announced today by Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. Randall Archibald, welcome to Fresh Air. In February, Attorney General Eric Holder called Mexico's drug trafficking organizations a national security threat to the United States. In what ways has it become a security threat to our country?
Well, I think what he was referring to was the spread of the Mexican drug cartels and their operatives and various affiliates to various places in the United States. In December, the Justice Department put out a report that identified 230 U.S. cities that had the presence of a Mexican drug trafficking organization, whether that was a cell, as they call it, of a cartel, or a homegrown drug trafficking organization distributing their cocaine and marijuana and other illicit drugs. In addition to that, there are several cities that are becoming alarmed at what they see as a spike in drug crime and drug-related crime, including Tucson, where I was recently. It's had a wave of home invasions that the police suspect and have, in some cases, have proven are drug-related. And they believe it's sort of a shockwave from the chaos that's going on in Mexico now with the crackdown on the four major cartels and all the bloodshed on that side.
You say about 60% of the drugs coming from Mexico to the United States go through Arizona. So is the whole state being affected by this?
When you say the whole state, you have to remember that at the border, drug seizures are a regular occurrence for the Border Patrol and for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In addition, Tucson and Phoenix serve as sort of hubs for the transfer of the drugs once they're in Arizona to various parts of the United States. The freeways are very conducive. There's a lot of north, south, east, west routes. It's a little bit of ways from the border, so there may not be, particularly in the case of Phoenix, there may not be such a heavy Border Patrol presence. So geographically, it's sort of well-suited, in a way, for the transfer and transportation of drugs to other parts of the country.
Since Arizona is a border state, I understand why Arizona has become a hub for drug trafficking from Mexico. But you write in your story this week that Atlanta has become a new staging ground for Mexican drug traffickers. Why Atlanta?
Well, if you've ever been through the Atlanta airport, then you know that it's a very large airport with a lot of connections to the rest of the United States. In a similar vein, the drug traffickers have discovered that Atlanta, geographically, and the infrastructure, the freeway system, likewise, is very conducive to moving drugs either coming up through Florida, the sort of older traditional way, and also through the Southwest. Again, through Atlanta, you can get almost anywhere. You can go right up the eastern seaboard to the thriving drug markets up north. You can go to other pockets of the South. You can get to the Midwest. You know, Atlanta, a lot of businesses are located there for that very same reason. And likewise, the DEA, you know, over and over will tell you these cartels are really organized like a well-organized, you know, FedEx or Walmart distribution system.
In what sense do they compare?
Well, in that they have a, you know, very sort of organized command structure in Mexico. In the case of marijuana, it's grown there. It's bundled there. It's shipped north. In the case of cocaine, most of the cocaine still comes from South America. And they have allegiances with the South American cartels to move the cocaine through Mexico. And the reason for that is in large part because the United States has had some success in cutting off the Caribbean and South Florida. You remember the Miami Vice days.
Yes.
Of yesteryear. Well, you know, as a result, you know, there was really a lot of heat applied to South Florida and the Caribbean, you know, using the Coast Guard and military resources to spot and track ships and the various planes coming in. It's not completely cut off there, but it's certainly had a significant impact. And what it did was it forced the Colombian cartels to make alliances with the Mexicans to move the cocaine through Mexico, where there are established smuggling routes for marijuana and other products. Likewise, methamphetamine used to be in the United States. Meth labs were proliferating everywhere, especially in rural areas. Now, as a result, you know, a lot of legislation went through prohibiting the sale of prescription medication that facilitated the production of methamphetamine. Those methamphetamine labs, while they haven't disappeared, they certainly have really dropped significantly in the United States and have shifted to Mexico in what they call quote-unquote super labs in Mexico that now produce it. And then the cartels ship it, likewise, through their routes up north.
Most of the guns that the Mexican cartels used are smuggled in from the United States. Mexico has really strict gun laws. What have you learned about how guns are bought in the United States and smuggled into Mexico?
Well, you're correct. The gun restrictions are very severe in Mexico, and outside of the black market, it's extremely difficult to get a gun in Mexico. On the U.S. side, we have laws that recognize the possession of a firearm is valid in some cases. So as a result, what happens is people go to gun shows or go to gun shops and buy them legitimately. You know, they submit their application and whatever is legally necessary. And what the cartels have done is line up what they call straw purchasers, which are basically people who have legitimate rights to buy a gun. They buy it legally and then turn it over to the smugglers and bring it into Mexico. So it's proven to be a very difficult phenomenon for the U.S. to really deal with.
Well, it's kind of paradoxical that the Mexican violence that's spilling over into the United States is being armed with American guns.
The American guns going south, like I said, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency estimates 90% of the guns used in Mexico's violence, which has now killed some 7,000 people since January 2008. The vast majority of them associated with the drug trade, but still that's a very high number. The ATF estimates 90% of those guns originated in the United States. So as the Arizona Attorney General put it, you know, we get the drugs, they get the guns and the cash. It's sort of a cyclical business in that sense.
My guest is Randall Archibald. He covers the Southwest for the New York Times. We'll talk more about the reach of the Mexican drug cartels into the U.S. after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Archibald. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times. He covers the Southwest for the Times and has written extensively about the border. And we're talking about the Mexican drug wars spilling over into the United States. There was a congressional report recently that said there's evidence that the Mexican cartels are increasing their relationship with prison and street gangs in the United States. What have you heard about that?
That's something that the federal authorities are somewhat concerned about. You have to understand a little bit about how the drugs are distributed in the United States. The cartels, as I said before, the bosses, the so-called kingpins, tend to stay in Mexico. The sort of upper command tends to stay in Mexico, directing the growing of the marijuana, the acquiring of the cocaine, the shipment through the country, all that entails. Once it crosses into the U.S., as the Drug Enforcement Administration explains it, it's usually transferred to what they call cells. And these are groups, criminal organizations that operate either in local cities or on a regional basis that basically serve as sort of sub-distributors. And, you know, they kind of take it from the border. They take it from hubs like Phoenix and Atlanta and disperse it, you know, further on down the chain to get to middle and lower level dealers and distributors. That's where the street gangs tend to come in. I don't think there's complete agreement in the DEA on this. I spoke to a DEA agent who said he is a little skeptical about whether the cartels would really want to kind of get in bed with the street gangs because the street gangs are a pretty volatile group. They could eventually become sort of rivals. So whereas other DEA officials believe that the cartels view the street gangs as a sort of logical place to go to help them spread their product further, the street gangs are already there. They're already mixed up in bad stuff. So I don't think there's complete agreement on that issue, but certainly they've picked up enough anecdotal and other intelligence to suggest that there are some connections being made.
Some experts are concerned that Mexico could become a failed state, and it would be very dangerous for the United States to have a failed state on its border. Have you heard many people expressing that concern?
There are certainly high-profile people expressing that concern. Barry McCaffrey, the former so-called drug czar under the Clinton administration, who directed the White House anti-drug policy group, recently visited Mexico and spoke to a lot of officials there and kind of collected his own intelligence and then put out a report recently where he warned of that very possibility. And there have been others who have followed suit or have had similar claims. The Mexicans, of course, are livid over this. They do not believe, while they clearly see the drug cartel problem is extremely serious, I don't think anyone there really goes and takes that extra step that, you know, the country is on the verge of collapse or on the verge of becoming a sort of Pakistan where leadership is very sort of unstable and there's all sort of questions. If you go to Mexico today, I was in Tijuana maybe a month or so ago, you could walk around Tijuana and actually be surprised. I mean, Tijuana is a very violent place for the drug business. There's certainly been a lot of grisly shootings and murders, attacks on police. But to walk around there, it doesn't really look like a place that is, you know, under siege, as you might say. People still go to the stores. They still go to the mall. They still go to restaurants. We went out to a restaurant at night, and there was, I wouldn't say it was packed, but there was a fair number of people there. It didn't have that sort of palpable feel of terror that people might expect from reading the headlines in the U.S. That said, like I said, it's a very serious place in terms of the drug business. I mean, you could end up in, you know, potentially dead if you work in that business in Tijuana. But I say that as sort of an indicator that while, yes, this is an extremely serious problem in Mexico, there isn't really sort of on the surface many signs that the country is headed, you know, so far downhill.
Do you think that the drug violence that has spilled over from Mexico across the border into the United States is related at all to the fact that in Mexico, the government of President Felipe Calderon has been trying to crack down on the cartels and their leaders?
Well, I think as a top-level Drug Enforcement Administration official told Congress the other day, spillover is sort of in his words, a tricky thing to define. Clearly, the Mexican government crackdown, coupled with the feuding among the cartels themselves, has produced this wave of bloodshed there. But whether that sort of high level of violence has spilled over into the U.S., I think most officials would say no, particularly along the border, you know, the border towns right on the border. That's what they're concerned about when you say spillover. They want to make sure that, you know, a running gun battle does not come breaking through a port of entry or through a gap in the fence or something like that. But the violence in Mexico, this sort of chaotic period going on among the cartels, I think a lot of U.S. law enforcement officials believe that there is sort of a shockwave emanating from that. And it's producing pressure on U.S. drug dealers on the U.S. side, drug trafficking organizations on the U.S. side, to not lose their drug loads, to not be very tolerant when a dealer says he came up short on cash or his load was confiscated. You know, I think it's partly that. I think if you ask the Tucson and Phoenix police, and DEA officials there, what they'll tell you is a lot of these local operators who have some, in some cases, loose affiliations or other sort of affiliations to the cartels are branching out their activities. They've discovered that, you know, it's much easier to rip off somebody's load than to be responsible for a load yourself. So there's this sort of branching out of activity going on among local players. There's a lot of trafficker-on-trafficker violence, as they call it. But even the DEA will say it's very difficult to establish a direct line between what's going on in Tucson and Phoenix, you know, straight back to the cartels.
Colombia used to be the country that seemed to be the big country for supply and for violence, particularly with cocaine. So how did Mexico take over a lot of the market?
Well, Colombia, as you said, was sort of the hot zone for this, in terms of cocaine. Cocaine is the coca plant is grown there and other places in South America. The cartels in Medellin and Cali and other places were very powerful in shipping that to the U.S. But eventually, Colombia and the United States together worked out a plan to really crack down and sort of really try to stomp them out. There was several $1 million spent. The U.S. sent a lot of resources, and it had an effect. And as a result, at least the shipment through South Florida and through the Caribbean was somewhat tamped down. Colombia went through a very, and is to some degree still going through a very bloody period, where the cartels reacted with, similarly a wave of kidnappings, prominent politicians, judges assassinated, not to mention some of their leading cartel members were killed. A lot of people say Mexico's, in an odd way, all the bloodshed there can be seen as a sort of success, that Mexico needs to go through this sort of period of real chaos and turmoil in relation to the drug trade before it can emerge on the other side as a more stable place, as a place where the cartels don't act with impunity. It should be noted that part of the plan with Colombia was to quote-unquote professionalize the police and military, basically really rooting out corruption and finding people who will take the job not because they know that they're going to get side payments from the cartels. Mexico still has a very serious problem with corruption seeping into the highest levels. So, like I said, whereas some U.S. officials see this as a sort of odd success. I know people don't like to attach the word success to so much carnage, but they see it as sort of a necessary evil before Mexico emerges and on the other side of them as a more stable place with a more professional police force and military.
My guest is Randall Archibald. He covers the Southwest for the New York Times. We'll talk about the new border security initiative announced this morning by Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Randall Archibald wrote yesterday's front page story in the New York Times about how Mexican drug cartels have extended their reach into the U.S. The interview with him we've been listening to was recorded yesterday. This morning, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano announced a new border security initiative, so we called Archibald for an update. Randall, would you sum up for us the main points of the plan outlined today by Secretary Napolitano?
Yes, the administration has decided to send a sizable increase in the number of federal agents to the border to assist local and state authorities there and supplement the already sizable presence of federal agents that patrol the border and make sure that violence doesn't spread from south to north. They also announced, and this is, I think, very important for Mexico, the increased use of technology, X-ray technology, to inspect vehicles going south to help detect weapons going into Mexico. Something like 9 out of 10 of the weapons that have been used in the killings there have originated in the United States, and Mexico has long sought some sort of way for the U.S. to control that flow of guns.
Do you think that the Mexican government will be satisfied by this move as being sufficient to dramatically cut down on the number of guns being smuggled into Mexico from the United States?
I think they'll certainly welcome this. There isn't a lot of inspection of traffic going into Mexico. The U.S. certainly inspects very aggressively people coming out of Mexico and entering the U.S. at the ports of entry, but there isn't a lot of inspection going south, either in the United States or, for that matter, in Mexico. I think the Mexicans would further like the U.S. to do something about the sale of these guns, including assault weapons, but I think for now they would welcome any effort on the U.S. side that might impede or slow down that flow of weaponry.
So is it a situation where the Mexican government wants the United States to do more to cut down on gun sales and to prevent guns from being smuggled into Mexico, but the United States says that Mexico should do more on the border to inspect cars coming across the border into Mexico?
I think both sides would like to see that. Mexico traditionally has not done a lot of inspection. You have to remember, people coming into Mexico spend money, and you know, it's sort of an economic issue. They don't want to really do much to interfere with that. At the same time, Mexico has also done a fair amount, not in terms of inspection, but certainly sending their military to the border cities to help contain that violence. So both sides really are taking steps that they had not previously taken to deal with the drug war. But I think both sides would also ask the other to do more on a range of issues.
What are some of the things that are not addressed in the plan outlined by Secretary Napolitano?
Well, I think the sort of elephant in the room is the use of the U.S. military at the border, most likely through National Guard. Secretary Janet Napolitano didn't really address that so much. She said that she would meet with Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who requested something like 1,000 or 2,000 National Guard troops at the border. This is something that the U.S. has previously done, but that was a couple of years ago to help the Border Patrol while the Border Patrol was building up a number of agents. And the National Guard troops didn't play really a direct role in apprehending people so much as doing supplementary work. So they left open the question of using the National Guard at this point, but President Obama and the Secretary have both said that they would consider it, and Secretary Napolitano is going to meet with the governor of Texas this week to discuss it further.
So does this strike you as a strong plan? Does it sound like it will really help cut down on the drug-related violence?
I think it's a step forward. Whether it's a strong plan or not, I think, you know, the devil is in the details, and really we'd have to see in exactly how the agents are deployed and how the technology is used and really what the success rate is of it. I mean, how many guns or cars do they stop and intercept and arrest and so forth. But it's clearly something that isn't really being done so much now. So in that regard, it's a step forward.
One thing I'm unclear of is how much of the plan is about increasing security at the border for people crossing the border, and how much of it is about more law enforcement in border towns?
Well, I think the two are sort of interrelated. I think that the main issue here at the border is that they don't want the, you know, really grisly killings and brutality to spill over directly into those border towns. I mean, that's the big concern in El Paso and Nogales and San Diego, and right on the border. So anything that they can do to contain it, I think, is kind of the goal that they're shooting for. At the same time, I don't think they want cartel operatives to get any further into the U.S. than they already have.
Any final thoughts you want to leave us with about the issue of how Mexican drug violence has crossed over into the United States?
No, I mean, I think this is sort of a almost a turning point of sorts. I mean, there's a lot of unprecedented things happening, both with this plan that they announced today in terms of stepping up, you know, southbound searches, you know, Mexico's use of its military and resolve to really make a strong effort to stamp out the cartels is something that they haven't seen this aggressively in the past. So we're sort of in a moment that could be a turning point in the drug wars.
Randall Archibald, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Randall Archibald covers the Southwest for the New York Times. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menjivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles at annenbergspaceforphotography.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a capsule history of how unregulated derivatives and swaps got out of control and sunk the global economy. We talk with Frank Partnoy, a law professor at the University of San Diego and a former derivatives trader at Morgan Stanley. In his 1997 book, Fiasco, he warned about the dangers of unregulated derivatives. Join us for the next Fresh Air.